From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Our connection this hour was made in a recording studio in the wee hours of the morning in 1967. After finishing a gig at the Tropicana Hotel in Las Vegas, Louis Armstrong headed over to his studio to lay down this track, which became a defining song of his career. Some sources say he was reluctant to record it at first because of the simplicity of the lyrics, but he did it anyway, even laughing off distractions during the session, like an unhappy executive and a noisy freight train. One could say he was, quote, acting human. The term is described by writer, musician, and director Richard Dubin as a practice of living in the moment, of mindfully writing one's own story. Richard Dubin has written an ebook on the subject, and it encourages readers to use the skillful means that artists use to create their art, to, as he says, live a life alive. We'll explore what that means this hour and also how art and life intersect. Well, that brings me back to Louis Armstrong. What a Wonderful World can be interpreted in different ways, as arguably most art can. Perhaps you view the song as an ode to peace and brotherhood, a song that encourages us to appreciate beauty and love. Or perhaps you hear a political message, a push for goodwill during a time of race riots, the restlessness of the Vietnam War, and other political and social changes. Maybe it's both. As reported by the BBC, Armstrong himself was dealing with pushback against the song. Here's what he said as he introduced it for one live performance. Quote, "Some of you young folks have been saying to me, hey, Pops, what do you mean? What a wonderful world. How about all them wars all over the place? You call them wonderful? How about listening to old Pops for a minute? Seems to me it ain't the world that's so bad, but what we're doing to it. And all I'm saying is, see what a wonderful, wonderful world it would be if only we'd give it a chance. Love, baby, love. That's the secret." End quote. It's no wonder Richard Dubin names Armstrong as an inspiration. Well, I couldn't get Louis Armstrong this hour, so instead I invited Richard Dubin. We'll have to deal with him for the hour. He joins me to discuss his new project, Acting Human, and how the concepts of mindfulness, creativity, and play intersect and can reflect social issues. He's a former Syracuse University professor, a network television producer and writer, and a professional trumpet player. Richard Dubin, welcome to Connections.
Hi, Megan Mack.
Also joining us on the phone from New York City is Lauren Toulagen. He's a composer, producer, broadcaster who has produced music for film, television, and the theater. He's the owner of Sandblast Productions and a collaborator on the Acting Human Project. Lauren, welcome to the show.
Hi, Megan. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm excited for this conversation this hour because we have a blank canvas to go in any direction we'd like to, because I think the concepts that you both promote in Acting Human are things that we can all relate to and all the connections to art. So I'm looking forward to it. Thanks for joining me. And I want to start the conversation just by asking you, Richard Dubin, what is Acting Human?
I think you described it well. It is a mindful means, a skillful means of creating a life. We, most of us, just assume that there's a default human condition. And I suppose there is, but it's fraught with conditioning. And to live a fully human life, these conditionings that we accept mindlessly create narrow paths for us to travel. The idea of acting human is to, in a skillful way, open to broader perspectives, ways of seeing and doing that are enlivening.
So what are some of these conditions that you think we mechanically, maybe blindly accept? And I know you mentioned in your book it's due to cultural norms. What are some of the specific things that you think are inhibiting us from living more in the moment?
Well, the kinds of things we learn in school. School is the devil. For the audience, Megan and I met in school. Megan was a student of mine at Syracuse University. So she knows something about school, and I know something about school. We shared some school. School conditions us to see what's wrong. Do you ever talk about anything that's right? We talk about things that are wrong and how to avoid things that are wrong, because we want to get the right answers on a test. Life is not a test. Life is life. We can risk the curiosity, the childlike kinds of ways in which we originally learned. We learned a whole lot of things without school. Then came school, which conditioned us to do all kinds of things and to see in certain kinds of ways. So think back to school and those kinds of conditions, testing, time, the isolation of place. It's a place we go to. The conditioning of being with a certain group of people, typically segregated by age and also by community. So all these limitations are, I don't want to blame it all on school. School's a big piece of it. But all these limiting kinds of beliefs, work is important, play is not, those sorts of things are the conditions that, the conditioning that I'm referring to.
This may seem like a silly question, but are you advocating for no school? Are you advocating for a very different educational setting? And Lauren, I'll let you jump in here as well. I see what you're saying. We're taught to question. We're taught to find what's wrong. And it reminds me of concepts in comedy and improvisation, where you want to approach every conversation by saying yes and rather than no. But right. In this society, and perhaps in schools especially, we're taught to do the opposite. So how do you find a balance between what we might need to take away from school settings, the skepticism that can be valuable?
Well, skepticism. Go ahead, Lauren.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
What I would say about that is one of the things that Dubin touched on and is at the heart and the soul of this thing is a spirit of curiosity, is about your willingness to explore what moves you. What moves you, as Oliver Sacks said. What are you curious about? What excites you? What do you feel yourself drawn to? Not as we learn in school, what's the best way for me to make a living? What should I study so I can go to university, get out, get a job, and then start buying stuff, which is ostensibly the American dream. And I'm not being dismissive of money whatsoever. I'm not. That's something we can also explore together.
As a matter of fact, send money to us here at WXXI.
I didn't even ask him to do that.
Yes, please. No, not to XSI. Put my name on the check. They'll just collect it and hold it.
Oh, never mind.
Even
better. But instead of that, what about a spirit of curiosity, of excitement about and opening our hearts to a sense of vulnerability? We will continue to talk about this, but the three of us are playing a scene right now. We are playing a scene in the Universal Theater right now. Megan, I don't know what you're going to say to me. You don't know how I will respond. I don't know what Dubin will say, but we are improvising. We're having this moment, playing a scene with open hearts, hopefully, and intentions and curiosity to explore the creative process together. Why can't that be much more of what our education as human beings is about, so that we are literally learning how to live life alive?
I just want you to know, Lauren, that I have a cough button and you don't.
How that's empowering. You raise an important point, Lauren. And last week on this program, we had a conversation about should the Regents exams be overhauled? And we had a teacher here in the studio who said that, well, she's against standardized testing in general, but she said these tests are judging students on their progress right when they're ready to graduate. So, you know, a student either graduates or doesn't. And we're not taking into account all the factors of how students learn, and maybe some just aren't good test takers. And are there different ways that we can create assessments that take into account those alternative ways of learning or the things that maybe a student excels at that is off the beaten path?
I have some experience with the Regents. I didn't take them. So I got what's called a general diploma. And last, if you are the same Megan Mack, right?
I haven't changed.
Did you call me professor?
I just called you Dubin.
No, just now. But was there a time when you called me professor?
Absolutely.
Did you walk into a room thinking you were dealing with a professor?
Yes.
Well, I essentially a high school dropout. So
what did I pay all that money for?
I foolishness. Foolishness. We could have met somewhere else, which is the way I think education needs to be reformed. So people who would benefit from knowing one another can meet in ways that are not mitigated by the institution, and it is an institution, so we're institutionalized, which maybe some people enjoy, but it is an institution of school. It's unnecessary. It can serve a very limited role, but not in its current form.
I'm curious to know how long you felt this way, because you were a professor for 20, maybe 30. How long were you teaching at Syracuse?
It only seemed like 30 years. 18 years.
18
but,
years.
But they were academic years.
Okay.
Which are different than dog years. Dog years are much longer than academic years. There's a good reason for that. Because the universe has intelligence. Academic years are shorter than dog years because there's a necessity to preserve the liver health of students. If each year was a dog year, everybody would graduate with cirrhosis, and it would be a really terrible problem. Did you know how much drinking goes on at Syracuse University?
It was just named the number one party school in the country.
Exactly. So let's get real about what's going on there. You're in a ghetto of people between 18 and 22 who are mostly leaving home for the first time. Free at last. Let's get loaded.
Wow, this conversation is going in directions I did not expect it to. So
perhaps
we're doing what's being referred to as acting human.
Yes, it is.
But I want to go back to my question. Are you advocating for no institutionalized education settings? What would you like to see if you could
to see education as a self-organizing process so that people found each other based upon a community of intentional folks who want to help others to learn the things they truly want to learn based upon curiosity, as opposed to formalized curriculum happening with people of certain ages moving in lockstep. I said lop, but I didn't mean that. I mean lockstep from grade to grade. 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, 7-year-olds, all the way till 18-year-olds. Oh, we'll go to college where we'll drink heavily, and on we go. This is the ghettoization of our lives by age.
Lauren, do you agree?
I do indeed. Dubin and I have talked about this at length. I have 3 sons, the youngest of whom just graduated from a college in Pennsylvania, a well-known university. His experience towards the end of his time there was abject fear and terror, this anxiety of, oh my God, I'm getting out into the real world now. What am I going to do? How am I going to find a job? What's going to happen? And as Dubin and I discussed, he saw literally, again, thank you, Edward, our mutual friend, Edward. He saw thousands of kids just like that at the end of their college experience, racked with panic. And I'm not across the board. This is not 100%, but it's a lot.
Overwhelmingly.
Who are scared to death of, oh my God, now what am I going to do? I'm free. No one's going to tell me what to do. No one's going to tell me what test to take. No one's going to give me the curriculum I need to study. Now what am I supposed to do with myself? This is what we're putting out into the world. This is what we want to do to our children. How does that make sense?
The principal thing we need to learn as we grow is we can find what to do next.
What about people that thrive on structure, though, and appreciate having an organized situation in which I'm in this class with people my age, we're learning the same thing, we're being assessed, I know I'm capable of moving forward. What about people that thrive on that kind of structure?
I suspect they do not thrive. I suspect they think they thrive because they've been conditioned to believe that they are the exceptional ones in that setting. Those people who thrive on it are those people who are told, You're a terrific student. Here's an A. Here's another A. Here's another A. And they graduate and don't know what to do. Same like the people with C's. Same like the people who get all manner and means of grades, which are another useless phenomena in school situations. Was I on the no grade program when you were there?
I don't think so.
Really? What was your grade?
I don't remember.
Right.
But I was no fun, so I probably did very well.
I'm sure it was an A. I'm on the all-A program. Mm.
Listeners, I want to hear what you think about what you're hearing regarding acting human and just these conversations we're having about structure, organized settings, the education system. You can weigh in on a lot this hour. You can join the conversation by calling 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can email the program at connections@wxxi.org. You can find me on Twitter at mmacmedia. So I'm sure we'll go back to education at some point.
Can I just say one more thing about structure?
Yes.
It is not as if imposed structure is the only kind of structure. Once we start noticing, there's structure everywhere. I mean, there's composition, there's rhythm, there's all kinds of structure in our living experience, which we are not noticing because, in large measure, we're focused on the structures that are imposed upon us. So it's not a matter of structure, no structure. It's a matter of noticing the variegated, the beauty of all the structure that exists in every manner and means, in every moment of our lives, if we are open to it.
That's a very good point. You're a musician. You're a trumpet player. Lauren, you're a composer. Let's talk about how all of this intersects with the arts, because there are sections in Acting Human where you write about jazz and discuss different musical settings. So let's make those I don't like the pun, but let's make those connections.
You know, Lauren had a show called Connections.
I heard that.
Yeah. Okay. So there's a connection.
Here in New York radio. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. We're on Connections again. Well, I was never on the old Connections. This will fix that.
Yeah.
So when it comes to music, how does Acting Human connect to music?
You want to talk to that, Lauren, or would you like me to do it?
No, you jump in, and then I'll follow.
Okay. It's all music. Everything we do is music. We're doing music now. For instance, we're speaking. The essence of this speech is not the words, it's the vibrational nature of what we're doing. Music is a vibrational phenomena, and we are making music now. We tend to think of music as though, well, music nowadays, who knows what music is? It's people screaming about God knows what with a bass booming, and we call it music. Or there's Tchaikovsky, or there's Bach, or there's there's a lot of kinds of music. The one thing that's true of all of it is it's vibrating. All of life vibrates. It's all music. We are vibrating. Our cells vibrate. Everything we're made of vibrates. We vibrate in ways that are connected with the environment we're in. We're vibrating, you and I. I don't know where you are, Lauren, but Megan and I are in a radio studio, a nice one. And we're vibrating in here. There's a booth. I can't see the booth because I'm not allowed to turn in that direction. I was told that I need to stay on mic at every moment. And so I don't know what's going on in there. Those guys could be doing anything at all.
They're pointing at you dramatically.
Okay, good. Pointing at me dramatically.
Lauren, what are your thoughts on the connection between Acting Human and music?
We have dead air here.
Well, yeah, the point about vibration is spot on. We are all simultaneously vibrating, which is why music, as we think of it, sounds that are made by musical instruments, people blowing into trumpets or pulling bows against string, why that speaks to us so deeply is it's vibrating. And when our vibrations and those vibrations mesh, it is an altered experience. I've talked about some of the work that I do at the Metropolitan Opera House. And Dubin and I have talked about that as expansive and theater writ large. But there are moments when the music is playing and the lights are working and someone is singing where you know you're sitting in New York. You know it's people pretending, and I say that in air quotes, on a stage. You know that there's a hustling and bustling street just outside the theater. You know it's, again in quotes, make-believe. But when it all comes together, you're sitting in a theater and you can't breathe. You are so moved. You are so taken. It's a transcendent experience. That's the power of music and an open heart and a curiosity and a vulnerability. Those are the experiences that are available to all of us. And it just doesn't happen to be in a theater. Again, it comes back to the scene the three of us are playing now. This idea that acting is just something that happens on a stage is silly. We're acting all the time, living lives of intention and an open heart and curiosity. That's the point.
Lauren, you remind me of a story from, I think it was May of this year, where I think in the Boston area, there was a symphony performance, a very powerful one. And at the end, there was a brief moment of silence, and then a 9-year-old boy just said, "Wow." And it turned into this great viral story that eventually they found out who the boy was, and I think they gave him some free tickets. But this young boy who had never been to a concert like this before was so moved that he just said, "Wow," right after. And I think he is on the autism spectrum, and his parents or family members brought him to this performance thinking this might be something he could relate to, and he absolutely did.
And what I was going to say until you mentioned the autistic component is that how wonderful that he hadn't been brainwashed or conditioned that, oh, you don't say anything when the music ends, or you politely sit and wait for other people to applaud before you allow yourself to pause. No, he was moved by it, and he said what came to him. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Why can't there be more of that?
That's so true, because there are so many norms that we follow now at performances and different situations where you're right. I find myself maybe suppressing how I feel about something because I have to, you know, abide by whatever social rule there is. So I love that point. That's a great point. I'm seeing the phone starting to ring. Up first on the phones is Jeff in Brighton. Go ahead, Jeff.
Hi. Your wisdom is such a breath of fresh air. And I was wondering whether you are aware of John Taylor Gatto, who passed away a year ago, voted best teacher of the year in New York State and New York City numerous times. And when he retired, he did research on what was really going on because he was so discouraged in his work. And if he had to follow the rules, he never held class with his kids. He was very successful, so he got the award because he didn't follow the rules. But Gatto found that when it was a voluntary situation in the 1850s, let's say, the literacy rate was almost 100%, and then these true believers, elite intellectuals, got in there, and they thought a utopian life is if you do what you're told, everything will go fine. So they made it compulsory, and the genius of it is it's in a monopoly because it's compulsory, and it's a system you can't stop, but the system's purpose is to break our spirits so we'll be good compliant people and good consumers, like you said, and good taxpayers and all that. So I wondered if you knew about his work.
I know Gatto's work very, very well.
Okay.
And I know John Holt's work very, very well. And a bunch of other people who talk about unschooling as opposed to homeschooling. There's a distinction. And Gatto operated within the school system, as did I. I operated at a university in a way that caused people to ask all the time, how are you getting away with this? And the answer was, you know, I'm willing to leave. Not at some time in the future, like now, this minute. It can be over for me in a second. I'm going to do this thing in a way that I find consistent with integrity and consistent with the needs of the people I'm there to serve, the students. I was not about a curriculum. I did not teach a curriculum. I taught what came to be known as the Dubin experience. And people said, take whatever class you can with him, and you'll have the Dubin experience. I don't know that Megan was willing to testify to this, but many, many are. And while I don't compare myself to John Gatto, I got a couple of Teacher of the Year awards doing exactly what I'm saying here. I did it for a variety of reasons, which this particular get-together is not about. And they served my purpose. The last thing in the world I expected to do was teach in a university, because it's just as I said, I'm a high school dropout. They gave me a general diploma because they were sick and tired of having me in a room harassing them. That's the bottom line.
That's the truth of it.
The comedy at their expense was too much for them to take.
Well, John,
wonderful.
I hope that
thank
it, does
you.
That answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, good. Thank you for calling.
Bye, John.
We're going to shift to our only break, because when we come back, I have questions for Richard and Lauren about what is art. I have questions about teaching empathy. Basically, I have a lot of questions.
Okay.
So let's do our only break of the hour. When we come back, more with our two guests and more on Acting Human. I'm Megan Mack, Wednesday on The Next Connections. In our first hour, we talked to candidates for Rochester City Council. Back in June, we talked to candidates running in the Democratic primary. And now that that's wrapped up, we talked to candidates from different parties to hear their platforms and priorities. We'll hear from the three candidates running on the Green Party line and also the Republican candidate. Then in our second hour, a conversation about tipping. Has etiquette changed? What do you think? That's Wednesday. You're listening to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson today. We're talking about a concept called acting human, and I'm joined by Richard Dubin, a writer, musician, and director who has written an ebook on the subject. Also, Lauren Toulagen, who's a composer, producer, broadcaster, and owner of Sandblast Productions in New York City. Before we move into some questions I have about art and language, Richard, where can people find your book if they're interested
they
in learning
can't.
More?
They
can't.
The book.
Great promotion.
The ebook. Well, I'm not here to sell anything. I'm here to just put out kinds of ideas that are on my mind and that hopefully some people will resonate with and take an interest. The ebook is quite beside the point. It, although it's provided a guide for you, it was written before I went to the Edinburgh Festival some years ago. I can't remember how many, 4 or 5 years ago. And I did a month of presentations / one-man performances based upon this material. And at that point, it was anticipated that this would have a life of a different kind. Life took its course. And acting human as a saleable phenomena is at present unavailable, not even at Wegmans, and Wegmans has everything. So there's no ebook to be had. There's nothing to be had. You're welcome to call WXXI, speak to Megan, and she might be able to arrange a coffee date for you and I.
I know that you and Lauren are working on, I believe it's a podcast, where you're talking to some fairly well-known people about their views on all these issues.
Well, you just asked me about my medical appointment tomorrow morning. Well, I'm going to tie this in.
I'm curious to know where the connection is here.
Yeah,
I'm just going to sit back and let you talk.
It's a good idea. I had some surgery. We were working on a podcast, and we did record a bunch of them, and they are in raw form. A couple of them are sort of produced, and they were a lot of fun to do. And we had this expectation that we would take Acting Human out with a podcast, with workshops, with that we would involve ourselves with it in a way that was intense. I, however, could not walk. This put a kind of damper on the process. And I had, a year ago May, some surgery here in Rochester. And now, I think you noticed, What a fine walker I am.
Fantastic.
Did you see me? Am I one of finest walkers you ever saw?
One of the best walks I've seen from
yes,
the door to the chair.
I walk really well. I'm willing to walk around some more so you can observe it. I'm a fine walker these days. A tribute to the fine surgical skills of Dr. Paul Rubery here at the University of Rochester Medical Center. And my hard work over the last year to say, hey, I think I'll walk, as opposed to riding the scooter that I otherwise would have had with flames and stuff. So
the podcast has taken a backseat for a moment.
The podcast, the whole Acting Human project, as was defined in Edinburgh, and then mm-hmm. after that, is on hiatus.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I want to ask a few questions about it, if I can.
Sure.
Just about your process, and Lauren, I'll bring you back in as well, because I know Andy Richter has a new podcast, and I believe it's called... Oh, the Three Questions podcast. It's fairly new. And he only invites people he wants to talk to. He's been pitched several high-profile people, and he told Conan O'Brien, I'm not really interested in talking to that person. I only want to talk to people that I'm interested in. And he brings them into his studio, and he asks them three questions. And those questions are, where do you come from? Where are you going? What have you learned? So for the duration of the podcast, they explore those three questions. And from what I gather about the work that you were doing before you had to take a step back, you were trying to get a sense of...
It's a very clever step, Black. I couldn't say you're on top of this thing.
I am.
That's crazy. Oh, it's a beautiful thing.
But it seems like some of that work was similar. You're asking open-ended questions, or I believe you were, and just getting perceptions on how people consider this acting, this mindful living. Is that fair to say?
It's yes.
Okay. Lauren, did you learn from those interviews... Did you learn anything that surprised you?
yes.
No names.
Yes, no names. But the capacity for people who are well known to the public in that they are well known actors who work all the time. The capacity for them to not fully understand the work that they're doing is remarkable. Dubin and I have had moments of not only at the moment looking at each other as though to say, can you believe what's happening here? But then after the fact to have returned time and again to the scene, not necessarily of the crime, but the scene of the conversation, to say, I can't believe that someone who's doing this at a high level feels that way or thinks that way. It's again, Dubin's point earlier about conditioning and about I'll leave it at conditioning. Is so spot on. Even if we find ways to break through some of that, some of our indoctrination, we still have to fight against it regularly because it's so easy to get sucked back into, this is what a good person does. This is how you behave when you're in a civilized society. These are the rules. This is where you go left instead of going right. And look, some rules are important. It's good that we all know that at a red light, you stop. That's a very important rule that we
all follow. Of course, it's the middle of the night and you see no vehicles coming. Then if you're
Correct.
Standing
Don't
and waiting for a light.
On this show.
If you're standing in the middle of the night waiting for a light when there's nothing to be seen in any direction, there's something wrong with you. You need to cross the street, not
right.
wait for a light. As Moms Mabley, the brilliant comic known to few these days, said... Boy,
Moms Mabley
said, not me, Moms Mabley. Moms Mabley said, boy, you don't have to be worrying about no light. Ain't no light going to hit you. It's the cars what hits you. And that's the truth. So if there are no cars, what meaning do the lights have? None.
Yeah, exactly. But my point, again, is...
In traffic, lights serve a purpose.
Even the actors who work all the time don't fully grasp what the concept of acting human is in terms of your daily life, in terms of living, in terms of your day-to-day, moment-to-moment. Acting, as I said before, is not just about 2 hours on a stage at 8 o'clock at night when the curtain goes up. It's how are we acting right now? How are Megan and Dubin and Lauren acting right now? When you see your kids in the morning, how is that acting happening? How can we bring all the tools that actors bring, a vulnerability, intention, immediacy, we're here now and only now. How can we bring that to our daily life, to every moment, and to live as fully alive as we can be? That's ultimately what it's about.
I want to take your question, Lauren, and explore it, because I think maybe some listeners who are hearing that will push back and say, that's really idealistic. I would love to live my life that way, but I've got a job to go to. I have bills to pay. I feel like I can't live in the moment because I'm running from one thing to the next all the time. And how would you respond to people like that? I know maybe the impetus is to say, well, you know, just slow down, make different choices. But we live in such a, you know, fast-paced society where we have lots of obligations. How can we make that concept less idealistic and more realistic?
Well, why do we have these obligations? How did that happen? Did they just get dumped on us? Or did we follow a path that took us into a place where people will come to me and over the years have said things to me like, well, I would love to do that, but I have a family now and I have to take care of my familial responsibilities. I just can't do that thing that I want to do because I'm married. I've got kids. Well, wait a second. Who decided to get married? Did someone force that on you? Did someone tell you you needed to get married and have children? Did someone say this is the thing to do? Or did you at some point make a decision? Okay, well, maybe I'll settle for it. I'm not saying that everyone who gets married is settling. I certainly don't feel that way. But did some other set of circumstances or thoughts or feelings compel you to pursue a certain path that now has taken you away from your curiosity and your vulnerability? It's unfair to say, I really want to do this, and then blame your circumstances for keeping you from it when you actually created those circumstances for yourself. That's
or at least cool. Co-created them. The conditioning goes to this whole idea. The question is a conditioned question. It's a black and white question. It's this or that, either or. It's not a yes and question.
That's fair.
It's not coming from yes and.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, these are my circumstances, and this is what I'd like to do. How do we play whatever game is necessary to get from what is, which is not necessarily the only possibility. It's what we've been led to believe is the only possibility, or a set of possibilities, given the conditioning we've been subjected to ad nauseum. I mean, this conditioning thing is fierce. It's not like it's just some kind of namby-pamby piece of conditioning. It's fierce. And the black and whiteness of it is a very important part. Right, wrong.
Mm-hmm.
There is, okay, this is the circumstances. This is the game we're in. Let me suss out the game. An improvisational truth is, if we're in a scene, we want to know what is the nature of the game of this scene so we can play it better. Life is this game. Game is generally seen as a pejorative, but there are different kinds of games. There are finite games, infinite games. I recommend a book all the time by James Karsh called Finite and Infinite Games. You read this book, I think it'll do you a lot of good. Read it every year. Give it a chance to seep in. This idea of black and white is really absurd, and because there's no black without white, and there's no white without black. We're looking at a continuum. So to see things in terms of either or, which is what we are taught to do, right, wrong in particular, is crippling.
I want to build on the idea of constraints when it comes to language. So in the ebook, Richard Dubin, you write, you include a quote by George Carlin, which is, quote, "By and large, language is a tool for concealing the truth." Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you're familiar with the euphemisms bit, the George Carlin euphemisms bit.
I probably am, but I'm, you know, absent of the bit right now.
Well, good. Lucky for you, I have it. I pulled
it.
So I would like to listen to
George
that.
George is going to be here with us?
He is joining us for the show.
Okay, he has a voice from the grave.
So I'd like to listen to that and then talk about constraints as it relates to language. We'll ask Lauren and Richard what they think. So here's George Carlin.
There's a condition in combat, most people know about it, it's when a fighting person's nervous system has been stressed to its absolute peak and maximum, can't take any more input. The nervous system has either snapped or is about to snap. In the First World War, that condition was called shell shock. Simple, honest, direct language, two syllables, shell shock. Almost sounds like the guns themselves. That was 70 years ago. Then a whole generation went by, and the Second World War came along, and the very same combat condition was called battle fatigue. Four syllables now. Takes a little longer to say. Doesn't seem to hurt as much. Fatigue is a nicer word than shock. Shell shock. Battle fatigue. Then we had the war in Korea, 1950. Madison Avenue was riding high by that time. And the very same combat condition was called operational exhaustion. Hey, we're up to eight syllables now. And the humanity has been squeezed completely out of the phrase. It's totally sterile now. Operational exhaustion. Sounds like something that might happen to your car. Then, of course, came the war in Vietnam, which has only been over for about 16 or 17 years. And thanks to the lies and deceit surrounding that war, I guess it's no surprise that the very same condition was called post-traumatic stress disorder. Still eight syllables, but we've added a hyphen. And the pain is completely buried under jargon. Post-traumatic stress disorder. I'll bet you, if we'd have still been calling it shell shock, some of those Vietnam veterans might have gotten the attention they needed at the time. I'll bet you that. I'll bet you that.
Richard Dubin.
Well, I love George Carlin. I'm glad he could be here with us today. Here's the thing. Language is a tool. Language is a tool that most of us never learn to use. We use it all the time, seemingly, in school and other places. We're using it now. There's no reality to the words themselves. The words are meaningless. They point at things. They point at experience. What George Carlin was after here, what this brilliantly written bit points at, is the idea that language separates us from experience. In his structure, this gag he does, this extended gag, we can hear shell shock. It feels like it's what Mel Brooks talks about when he talks about the word shower. It sounds like what it is to the 2,000-year-old man, shower. Everything was animatic, poetic, as he says. It's all metaphor. Language points at something. It is not the thing. There's a man by the name of Alfred Korzybski, a Polish fella before George Carlin. And he talked about an academic area called general semantics. And the basic message of general semantics is the map is not the territory. You need to walk through a place to know the place. You can't look at a map and know the place. You can't use a word and know what the thing is. The thing isn't even the thing. The thing is a connection, a way into this whole living experience, the entire universe. Nothing exists independent of all the connections it has with everything else. None of it is independent. We are interdependent. We are connected right here on Connections. Mm-hmm. And understanding this, not understanding it intellectually, but understanding it experientially, is at the heart of what Acting Human is about. So language, when it serves us, is a beautiful thing. When it is a restrictive element that keeps us from our experience, because we know the word. So hey, we're done. Got a word. Finished.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lauren, I'm sure you have some thoughts on this too.
Well, the word tree is not a tree. It's something that represents our experience of a tree. And Korzybski, Dubin and I have talked about Korzybski a lot. It's very convenient for the three of us to have some kinds of language skills so that we can sit here for 45 minutes or an hour and have a conversation. Language is very helpful in that regard. But as Dubin points out, to the extent that it separates us from our experience of truly living alive in the moment, it's problematic. And we see it repeatedly in the world, both locally and universally.
I think we could do a whole separate hour on how the two of you, both musicians, producers, could answer the question, what is art? And I want to approach this in our last few minutes as briefly as we can, but I think it was last week or the week prior on the show, we had a conversation about food as art. And we talked about, well, what is art, to, as a gateway into that conversation. And one of the guests said, if I walk into an art museum, I have to have the thought in my mind that I'm going in to see art. Because if I see a urinal on a wall, well, I have to perceive that as art. I'm in a museum. But if I walk into a space and just see that, perhaps I conclude that it's an unfinished bathroom. So I'm wondering, you know, the cultural constraints we have on what is art, what should art be? When you approach it from the perspective of Acting Human, how is it different, Lauren?
that's quite a question. What I've learned the most from my time with Dubin, which has been many, many, many years, and I'm grateful for all of them. And continue to be for our relationship and our experience together, is remaining curious, remaining open to the moment, and being alive in my consciousness and awareness as best I can be. And what art does for me is changes my awareness. It transports me on some level, whether it's a painting, a piece of music, language in a novel, whatever it may be. It's transformative, and when I am feeling deeply and am moved deeply in that transformation, is when I find art to be at its most powerful.
The art is not context dependent. So the question, what is art, is a question that seeks to define something that's not definable. It's only defined in terms of context, typically. As you pointed out, if we're in a museum, it must be art. Well, you know, I was just moments ago, I was at a urinal. It was a very arty experience. I felt deeply about it. I couldn't wait to get there. The Mona Lisa was no more seductive than that urinal. Trust me, if there was the Mona Lisa on one wall and that urinal on another, I'm about the urinal. It was an experiential moment of great glory. And this idea of context, I'm in a museum, this must be art. I'm in an opera house, this must be art. And then there are levels of art depending upon the context. We're musicians, Lauren and I. Lauren and I have different musical experiences, some of them in common, But as a jazz musician, people think, well, nah, you know, there are a few people who think, well, this is art, and other people who think it's the kind of music that's made in saloons. It's, you know, it's a minor form of art. It's not opera. It's not a symphony. It's America's classical music for those people who get it. So what the context is something that's constructed based upon people's perception of what art is. Art is all of it.
I have thoroughly enjoyed this hour.
Me too.
I would like to thank Richard Dubin and Lauren Toulagin for joining me. We covered a lot of ground, and I learned a lot. I'm getting feedback from our listeners saying that they appreciate the wisdom of both of you. So thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Megan.
Pleasure.
Loved our time
us.
Together.
And even though there isn't an ebook to share or a podcast to share quite yet, you can look up Acting Human on Facebook. So just search Acting Human on Facebook. You can learn more there. So I'd like to thank my guests and also David Griffin, our volunteer, always helping us out. Thank you so much. Gary Putup on phones today, our engineer, the reliable and awesome Rob Braden. I'm Megan Mack filling in for Evan Dawson this week. We'll talk to you tomorrow.